This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
We discussed last week the nature of the mistake. What was it at the origin of the mistake which Chava made in following the advice of the Nachash? He said on the surface she did something which no ordinary person would do, and it's beyond our understanding to conceive how a person of the greatness of Chava could have committed such a crime. And we explained it was her very greatness which made it almost inevitable. Because she was incapable, until having eaten from the Eitz Hadas, she was incapable of understanding the possibility of a person doing something because it suited him. She knew the people did what was right, that was all. The fact that there could be impure motivation, that the fact that there could be political and expedient motivation, was something that was completely foreign to Chava. And therefore, when the Nachash talks to her, she analyzes the words of the Nachash on the basis of emes and sheker. So, is it objectively true or is it false? And she analyzed it statement for statement, and she finds that everything he says is true. The Nachash didn't tell a lie. Chazal in fact say that he's one of those wicked beings that caused mischief by telling the truth. And in that she fell. Because had she, instead of examining merely what he was saying, also examined why he was saying it, she would have realized that something doesn't fit here. If she would have said to herself, this Nachash is a politician, he doesn't do things for others. If he's talking like this, there's something in it for him. And I can't figure out what's in it for him. Therefore, I obviously don't understand what's going on here. I'm blind. I'm going to trip up here. There's something in the whole dialogue which I haven't understood. And she would have gone to Adam, and she would have told Adam the whole story, and Adam would have said, of course, he pushed you against the tree and nothing happened, because really when I told you that you mustn't touch the tree, it was a hachoke, it wasn't the essential thing, and so Adam would have explained to her, and it would never have happened. But she was so convinced that since there was nothing wrong with the emeskite, there was nothing wrong with the actual truth of the words of the Nachash, how could there be any harm resulting from the Nachash's advice? Why is motivation so important a concept? Why is it so important if a person gives advice which is good advice? Is it really that important to dig and to delve? What is his motivation? Why is he giving the advice? What kind of person is he? Is he a tomin? Is he a straight, simple person who's giving the best advice he knows for you, or does he have other cheshbonos? And if he has other cheshbonos, I must know what those other cheshbonos are. Because if I don't know what those other cheshbonos are, I cannot weigh up his advice. Is it really that necessary to dig and to delve, or once you've satisfied yourself that the words that you're saying are true, that that's all that matters? Why is it that motivation is so terribly important? And is motivation important also in other things? Not only advice, in mitzvahs that one does a constructive action, is it very important to also analyze why that constructive action was done? What was the man's intention in it? How important is that? And the answer is that it's very important. The reason that it's important is because in the motivation we have the foundation of the whole structure. The motivation is that which happens first to the human being. The very first step in doing anything or saying anything is motivation. That comes before any action. And therefore the motivation is the foundation stone. That's the bottom level. And the same way as if the foundation is crooked, if it's not level, the entire building is going to be tilted. So when the motivation is tilted, the entire action is going to be tilted. It's not possible to do something which is 100% correct when the motivation in it is not correct. Can't be. Doesn't mean that it's completely possible. Doesn't mean that it's completely disqualified and that it's no good altogether, no. But to say that it can be, or to conceive that it might be something which is entirely pure, that not. If the motivation is not right, then right throughout the structure there will be a reflection of that incorrectness. On every level, on every floor, you'll be able to see the reflection and the manifestation of the incorrect motivation at the outset. Last night we discussed the Chazal on Bayochel Noach Ishra Adomo Bayita Korim. That Noach, the man of the land, began and he planted a kerim, he planted a vineyard. And Chazal learned the double meaning of Bayochel, that Naaseh Chulin, that he profaned himself, he became secular, he became a man of the land when he planted this vineyard. And we learned from the Rashi that the stress was on Bayachel, on the fact that he began to plant, that that was his first action. First he should have planted other things. There's nothing wrong with planting a vine. What was wrong was with planting the vine first. The first plant should have been something else. And we discussed last night, what difference does it make? If wine was, there's nothing wrong in planting the vine, and Adarab, we learned that Noach did it at 100% in Shem Shemayim. Noach's intention was that there should be wine, so there'd be simcha in the world after such a terrible tragedy. Would be necessary for people also to be able to be mesameach themselves, that they should be able, one should be able to make kiddush and have dole and bring wine on the korbanos. Wine was something that was needed. It wasn't done just for his own drunkenness, chas v'shalom. It was done absolutely the Shem Shemayim. So there's nothing wrong with the tree, and there's nothing wrong with his intention in doing it, and yet he's criticized because he did it first. What difference does it make if he first planted the fig tree and then the vineyard, or he first planted the vineyard and then the fig tree? The difference is a difference of a few minutes. Is it going to make any difference in the ultimate layout of the world? There's going to be a fig tree and there's going to be a vine. Who cares which one came first? Is it that important which one was made first? And Chazal say yes. By Yachel he became profane by virtue of him putting the vineyard before the fig tree. What's so terrible? So last night we began to discuss it. And last night we said that it's true that the wine, the vine is the most lofty of all the of all the vegetation. It's that which enables the human being to reach the highest levels. That it is. There's most kedusha in the vine, we said. However, what was wrong was that one doesn't start at the top. In matters of kedusha, one starts on the first level, and one builds up step by step. In matters of secularity, in matters of chol, one goes up and one goes down. One sometimes starts with a bang, and one tries to maintain it. And if one doesn't, one comes down a little bit. It's not that important. We said that in matters of kedusha, what one has to look at is growth, and only growth. In matters of secular things, it's not where you're going; it's how much you've got. You measure a person's assets not by how much he had yesterday as opposed to how much he's got today. Measure his assets by how much he's got, full stop. Possessiveness is measured by quantity. Spirituality is measured by growth. Where was he yesterday and where is he today? What is the gradient of his movement? That's what you need to know in matters of Kedusha. So there's no point in matters of Kedusha starting off with a bang. Not the point. If you're not going to be able to maintain that and you're not going to be able to continue to build on that and to develop it, what's the point in starting with a bang? Rather start with one, and from one you go to two, and from two you go to three. That's great growth. And that's the way we do things. We're going to look at this a little bit further. It's a very strange Medrash Tanchuma on this. The Medrash says, Amru Rabbi Seinuzal, our rabbi said, Kashebo Noach Lito Kerim, when Noach came to plant the vineyard, Bo Sotun, the Omad Lefonov. Sotun came, the Satan came and stood before him. Omale, he says to him, Ma'atamitea, what are you planting? Omale Kerim, he said, I'm planting a vine. Omale Mativa, he said, a vine? Describe a vine to me. What's so important about a vine? To which Noach answered, Peirosov Mesukim, Ben Lachim, Ben Yeveshim. Firstly, he says, grapes are sweet dry and they're sweet fresh. You can have them as raisins, you can have them as grapes. So there's no wastage we can do with vines, because we can preserve them. And you can make wine out of grapes, so you've got double usage. It's not just the fruit, you've also got the yayin, you've got the drink as well, which causes people to become happy, as it says in Tehillim, v'yayin yisamach levavenosh. So we begin to see a little bit of the thinking of Noah over here. What did he want? He figured out which was most practical, out of what could he get the most use. That's what he was going to plant first. It's a good cheshbon. He's a good farmer. Amar le Sotan, so the Sotan said to him, he says, it sounds very good. Would you like a shutef? How about a partnership? We'll do this job together. Amar le lechai, he said, lechai, which is like lechaim. Yeah, that's a deal. Me'o Sotan, what did the Sotan do? He be keves, v'horgo etachas agefen. He brought a lamb, and he killed it, he slaughtered it under the vine. Achar kach hevi ari v'horbe. Then he brought a lion, and he slaughtered it. Achar kach hevi chazir v'horbe. And then he brought a chazir, a pig, and he slaughtered it. Achar kach hevi kuf. And then he brought a monkey, v'horbe, and he slaughtered it. Tachas hakerim, all under the vine. Vehitifu daman bo'isu hakerim. And their blood dropped and got absorbed into that vineyard, v'hishpuhu midameim, and they watered the vineyard with that blood. Stop there for a moment. What's this business? Where do we see any indication in the Torah that the Sotan got involved with the planting? Well, we see from the consequence, we see in the end that it didn't work out exactly as Noah planned, and we see that there was suffering, and then there was the degradation as a result of the killing. So we see that somewhere the Sotan got involved. But the Medrash says he got involved right in the beginning. He wanted a shutef, he wanted a partnership with Noah. And the Sotan also participated in the growth of this vine. Where do we see that? The answer is that same Rashi with which we started. Also, atzmoy chulin. He made himself, he desecrated himself, he made himself secular. Shehoyo loy lasek tchilo benetiyo acheris. He should first have involved himself with another form of planting, not with a vine. What does that mean? What is the role of fear? Why did God create such a thing as fear? Fear is a very great inhibitor of good activity, of good action. The Mesillas Yeshurim says in Perek Tes, Oid bimafsidei azrizus, another reason for which people are sometimes not zrizim, they're not active, they're not energetic and enthusiastic, is huroiv apachad, the gedil hamira. People sometimes get too scared, they're filled with fear and they're scared. I mean, as man vitil this, or from the normal things that happen during time. Kipam yiro me'akur or me'achim. Sometimes he's afraid of the cold, sometimes he's afraid of the hot. Sometimes from illness, sometimes from other forms of illness. Sometimes the wind, and so on. It's an interesting thing, this Mesillas Yeshurim. There are certain people, you know, in this place in Medrash we have a rule that when people can't make it to a shir, they have to apologize. Don't just not turn up. If the magid shir, if the person who's giving the shir takes puts in the necessary time and effort to prepare a shir and to attend, one's expected to turn up. If one doesn't turn up, one lets the person know before. And when people apologize, they very often give reasons. Just go, sorry, I can't come because such and such. And it's a very strange thing. The reasons are always unassailable. Taki, he's got a good time, he's got a good reason, there's nothing you can say. Can't come because, and it tells you the reason, what can you say? And yet, it's always the same people who have those unassailable reasons. It's a state of being. The lack of zvizuts, the lack of enthusiasm is a consequence of an emotion. The emotion is fear. Scared. One person is scared of his wife. The other one is scared of his mother-in-law. The other one is scared of his children, of his babies. People are scared. The other one is scared of his business commitments. The other one is scared of his... Each one has his own fears. What he's scared of. What will happen if Chas V'Sholom, he comes to the shir, if he maintains his fears? What terrible thing might happen? He's scared. And he builds these fears. So what is it? Is it the objective fear which is correct? It is correct. But the question is, why are you scared of it? So the reason that I'm scared of it is because I'm a scaredy baby. I'm scared of everything. That's what it is. There are some people who are perpetually scared of normal things. And others who handle them, do it, this can also be handled. It's not something that one has to be afraid of. First, the Mesillas Yesharim, that Mimafside as Rizus, one of the causes of not having enthusiasm, Uroiv HaPachad, being over scared. There's such a thing as being too scared. And he goes on to discuss when is one too scared and when is one merely being prudently cautious. One can't conduct oneself with complete abandon either. There is such a thing as being cautious. When do we regard it as caution and when is it over fear? So what did the Ribbono Shel Olam create fear for? In the physical area, we know why he created fear, to keep us away from danger. If people weren't afraid, they would do dangerous things. If people weren't afraid of fire, they would walk into fires. If people weren't afraid of the power of electricity, they would play with electricity and they would kill themselves. It's necessary to have fear. It's necessary to be scared of dangerous things, otherwise you won't protect yourself from that danger. And that's not a particularly human element. Fear is something which an animal has. That's the instinct of self-preservation. The basis of self-preservation is fear. Without fear, there is no self-preservation. That's the foundation of the concept of self-preservation. Is there a role for fear in the spiritual world? The answer is yes. There's such a thing as yiras chet. There's such a thing as being afraid of sin, which is different to Yiras Shamayim. Yiras Shamayim is standing in awe of the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's a different concept. Yiras Chet is a very primitive, straightforward, simple fear of the consequences of sin. That's all. The same as there's fear of electricity, and there's fear of wild animals, and there's fear of fire, so there's Yiras Chet, the fear of sin. And that's an element that one needs to develop, because if one isn't able to develop it, there is no spiritual self-preservation. One doesn't have the instinct to keep away from that which is harmful. Now that we know that zrizus and fear are the two players in the game, the opposite poles, where there's a lot of zrizus here, where there's a lot of fear, there's less zrizus. And we understand the role of fear and the purpose of fear, we begin to understand something else too. You say to your friend, come, let's take a walk around the block. And you see him saying, all right, but slowly. And you see him looking wherever he goes, and he puts his one foot forward, and then he looks around, and he puts another foot forward. He says, well, what's going on? He says, I'm scared, hurt. What do you think? It's dangerous. What are you scared of? He says, have you never heard of leopards attacking people? Have you never heard of such a thing? Leopards attacking people in Sydney? Well, and why not? You think a leopard can't get out of the zoo and get to Sydney? It's impossible. It can be. So he goes, carefully. He crosses the road. He looks backwards, forwards. He can't get across the road. Ever heard of a car coming? But there are no cars. And he says, and when people get knocked over, do you think they saw the cars? If they would have seen the cars, they wouldn't have crossed the road. So how do you know there are no cars? Cars can drive fast. They can suddenly appear, you know. So you don't cross the road. You would say the man's sick. Something is abnormal. And on the other hand, if you take a person to the Niagara Falls, and across the Niagara Falls, or the Victoria Falls, it doesn't really matter. There's a rope from the one side to the other. And you say, how about walking across the rope? And he says, fine. And he walks. So he has some sugar. No fear, isn't he scared? What's the difference? In the one case, you say he's mad because he shows fear. In the other case, you say he's mad because he doesn't show fear. The answer, the one thing he's about to do is commonly dangerous, and the other one is not commonly dangerous. And so the degree of zrizus, the degree of enthusiasm and of fear, demonstrates the person's attitude to how dangerous the action is. You're sitting at a roulette table, and you say to the person, come, let's have some fun, put some money on the roulette table. He says, okay, he says, I've got 1,000 rand in the world, that's all I've got, let's put it on. And he puts it on. You're mad? Absolutely mad. It's dangerous. You stand to lose it all? There's a 1 in 30 whatever chance it is that I might win. But it's a dangerous thing. It has a very good, the potential of winning is very good if you win. But the chances are that you won't win. And he's not scared. The man is sick. He doesn't understand the consequences of his action. He doesn't perceive the danger in what he's about to do. It's an abnormality. But you might have another man who sits and he figures out and he does some calculations and he works, puts his money on and he takes it off. Eventually, after a lot of thought, he puts it on. So you won't say he's mad. He's decided, he's worked, that he can afford this, and he's worked out the risks, and okay. After a lot of care and a lot of thought, with not terribly much zizus, but a lot of fear, he's taken the money out and he's put it on. Noach comes out of the table. What's the first thing he should have done? Does it matter if he first plants a vine and then he plants a fig tree, or he first plants a fig tree and then he plants a vine? There's too much zizus, that's all. You're too quick with the vine. So what's wrong? The vine is a constructive thing. It's an important thing to have. You see what he tells the sultan? You can make grapes and you can make raisins. You can eat it fresh. You can eat it preserved. You can eat them as fruit. You can eat it as wine. It's the samach levav enosh. Look at the tremendous usefulness that can be gotten out of this. Yes, Noach. But you only see the upside. You don't see the downside. Because if you would perceive the downside, you would do it a little bit more hesitantly. Not that you wouldn't do it, we need wine. Of course we need wine. But not so much zizus, not so much enthusiasm. There would have been a moment of hesitation. You would have first done the other things. You would have found ways, you know how it is when people are lazy. It's not that they never do what has to be done. It's just first they do everything else. They postpone it and postpone it and postpone it until you can't postpone it anymore, then they do it. That's how it should have been. Laziness is also a sign of fear. There are other reasons for laziness that Mr. Shishoyim goes through as well. Those who are afflicted by the disease should refer to chapter 9. But one of the reasons that he gives is this, is fear. One is an atzlan because one's scared, one doesn't want to get involved, but comes a time when you have to. Good to know, had he really been afraid of the consequences of the planting of the grape, should have shown a little bit of atzlanus. A little bit of atzlanus, a little bit of laziness. Do the other things first. Postpone the wine. What does his zrizus show? His zrizus shows lack of fear. Says the Medrash, that's where you see the sultan. This wasn't just a tzaddik's action on his own. Together with it, there's wrapped up a little bit, a tiny little touch, something which is so minute that we, with our gross eyes, would not be able to see it. But with a powerful insight, the Torah, and the placed under an electron microscope, the Torah picks out one little molecule of Satan there as well. It's not 100% the Shem Shemayim. Because if it was 100% the Shem Shemayim, it would have been a little more slow. It wouldn't have been quite as fast. I've told you often of the story of the Chaim Volozhin and the Vilna Gaon, where the Chaim Volozhin comes to the Vilna Gaon with his idea of establishing a yeshiva. And in those days, they weren't yeshivas as we know them today. In each town, the role of the town used to sit with Talmidim and used to learn. But the concept of building a yeshiva that had a building, a base of medrash, and hired teachers and staff, and Talmidim used to come from all over the world and learn in that particular yeshiva, under a Rosh Yeshiva, that didn't exist. And the Chaim Volozhin conceived of the idea of the first modern yeshiva. And when he put the whole concept together in his mind, he came to see his Rebbe, the Vilna Gaon. And he told him all about it and how we'll do this and we'll get the Rosh Yeshiva involved and we can build it in such a way and it wouldn't cost all that much and one could raise the money in this way and people would come from all over the country and to Volozhin and it would be wonderful. And the Vilna Gaon listens to the whole thing and then he says no. The Vilna Gaon wasn't the kind of person you could ask why not. He says no, so you go, finished. Years later, the Chaim Volozhin is sitting with the Vilna Gaon and he says, I still think, remember what I told you a long time ago about that yeshiva idea of mine? I still think it could work. I still think it's the right thing to do. And the princess turns around and says, so what are you sitting here for? Why don't you get it and make it moving, get it established? So the Vilna Gaon says, but I discussed it with you and you told me not to. He says, then you were too excited about it. You don't get that excited about something which is 100% L'shem Shemayim. When you get that emotional about something, when you get that excited about something, there are other calculations as well. It wasn't the right time to start. Don't start something. Those people on those levels could talk like that. If we talk like this, we'll never start anything. But they could say, don't start something if there's a touch of Shaloi L'Shem Shemayim in it. Because it will flounder. It won't work. Now I see that you're talking quietly about it. You're not that excited about it. Now I can understand. Now it's a... It's something which you're doing l'shem shemayim, and you should go ahead and you should do it. Had Noach come out of the teva and planted the vine, but not immediately with such enthusiasm, the Satan wouldn't have been involved and the whole thing would not have occurred. It was because of the very enthusiasm that the Satan gets himself involved, and that we find that it's not 100% l'shem shemayim. How does the Satan get involved? And why does the Satan love wine so much? Why does he get involved after with wine? The Tzayoka points out something very beautiful. That is that Anavim, if you spell Ayin Nun Beis Mem, Anavim, without the Yud, you do it Choser, Ayin Nun Beis Mem. And you take the letter before each letter. So the letter before Ayin is Samach, and the letter before Nun is Mem, and the letter before Beis is Aleph, and the letter before Mem is Lamed. That's spelled Samach Mem Aleph Lamed, small, which is one of the names in Kabbalah for the Satan. So the Tlayota suggests that wine is something which has within it the potential for the Satan to find the place. It's just where he likes to get involved. That's the kind of area where he can get best involved. Why is that? That we see from the continuation of the Medrash which we learned. The Satan comes along, you remember, and he slaughters first a lamb, then a lion, then a chazir, and then a monkey. Says the Medrash, Ramaz loy, he hints to Noach, Shekoidem sheyishte odo min hayayin, before a man drinks wine, hareyu tam kekeves, he's simple like a lamb, unaffected. Sheino yudas klum, doesn't know anything about what's going on. Shosuk kohegen, if he drinks a little bit correctly, arehu gibur ke'ari, he becomes as courageous as a lion. V'omer ein kemoisa bo'ilam, and he starts to think that there's nobody as powerful as me in the world. That's the stage at which driving under the influence of drinking is dangerous. Already at this stage, just even shosuk kohegen, even if one drinks correctly, one is like an ari. And the moment you're like an ari, you believe you're invincible. You believe nobody can damage you, nobody can harm you. And you can go, and everybody else is going to clear out of your way. There is that kind of feeling in the person who's drunk, even kohegen. Not drunk. Just he's had a little bit of drink in a way which is quite acceptable. Kivan sheshoso yosemidai, when he's drunk more than enough, na'ase kechazer, he becomes like a chazer already. Mislachlich b'mei raglayim v'dorache, he dirties himself and he's filthy and he's disgusting, he starts behaving like a chazan. Nishtakir, when he becomes drunk, the fourth stage, na'asek kuf, he becomes like a monkey. Oymei d'merake d'mesachik, he gets up and he dances and he plays. V'moitzilif ne'akol nevelus apeh, and nivul peh, disgusting things come out of his mouth. V'ini yodea mayas, he doesn't even know what he's doing. Those are the four stages of handling drink. And the Satan warns him, that's what you're planting. You're planting something which can convert a lamb into a monkey via a lion and a chazer. That's what it is. I've been taught that you don't overprotect a child. If you teach a child that he must never touch the medicine cabinet, the child will simply wait until you're out, and then he'll touch the medicine cabinet. If you teach him not to eat the pills, he'll wait until you're not looking, and then he'll eat the pills. He has to. It's human nature. Because he figures, the reason that you have to tell me not to eat them is because you know that it's something nice. Otherwise, you wouldn't have to tell me not to eat them. You don't suspect me of doing something that wouldn't be pleasurable. So you must suspect me of doing something which will be pleasurable. That's why you're telling me not to. So I wait till you're gone, and then I'll have the pleasure. That's what the child does. If you don't, what does the child do? The chances are the child will never come near the medicine chest. Unless he's playing doctor or something, in which case he might. And he'll take a tablet and he'll put it in his mouth, or he'll give it to his brother or sister to put in their mouth. And the moment it touches their lips, it's so disgusting, they'll throw it out. It doesn't taste nice. And when I was shown this by Rabbi Lipschitz, I said, oh, that's all very good, but what do you do about sugar-coated pills? He said, come, I'll show you. And he had two little babies, twins, and he left some sugar-coated pills lying around on the floor.
dangerous one. She says, watch, let's watch. And they carried on learning and we watched. They came, they tried, and they put them into their mouth. And then he fainted. And he was relaxed and calm. He says, wait, wait. They sucked up the sugar and spat it out as soon as the sugar was finished. There's no reason for them to carry on eating something which is foul. The sultan is not going to get us to do something which is unpleasant. That's not the way of the sultan. There's no chance that we're going to be persuaded by our Yetzirah to do nasty things, to do things which don't taste nice. Wine is interesting because it can change a lamb into a lion. That's the first step. You have a little bit of it and the lamb becomes a lion. All of a sudden he feels strong and powerful and brave and courageous the way he's always dreamed he wants to be. He's a superman. And he does a little kavachomer in his mind. If a little bit of wine can make a lion of a lamb, can you imagine what a lot of wine can do? And he carries on until he's a chazer. And he carries on and on. What the sultan needs is something the origin of which, the initial stages of which, feel positive and are good. That's where the sultan climbs in. That's where he gets the human being. That's why, as we've been learning in the Vilna Gaon recently, the place to watch out for the sultan is not out in faraway places. The closer one is to Torah, the closer the sultan is at hand. The more one is involved in things religious, the closer is the tendency to make a mess of it. The closer is the tendency to mishandle it and to ultimately destroy oneself with it completely. Wine has tremendous kedusha. It is with wine that one makes kiddush, that one makes havdalah, that one benches on a kos. Every Suddhist mitzvah has to have wine. We bring wine on the korbanos. And the mishandling of wine can cause one to become a kof, absolute monkey of oneself. That's the nature of the world. In things which have no kedusha at all, you don't have to worry. It's like the pills, it's like the tablets. They don't taste nice. Nobody's attracted to them. It's when things are wrapped up with a sugar coating. It's when you start tasting it that they taste nice. And by the time they're tasting nice, you've already lost complete control of yourself. And by then there's a desire to continue. That's where one has to be careful. Noach starts off with so much zrizus, with so much enthusiasm, that the Torah observes that mixed up in that is a little bit of the sultan. There's one tiny little particle of shelo lishmo, of it not being 100% l'shem shemayim. And the consequence of that is that not only are others affected by it, but he's affected by it too. The great thing that would have resulted had he planted the other trees first, is he would have been asked by his children, why not the vine? Why aren't you planting the vine? No, it'll say fig trees first. Plant the fig trees. The vine is still sitting in the pot. And what are we planting today? Today we're planting olives. And when are we going to plant the vine? No, tomorrow. Tomorrow, it's already Friday, and Shabbos. After Shabbos we'll plant the vine. Come Sunday, then we've got to water the olives and the fig tree. So I'd say, Father, why are you delaying so much on the wine? And he would sit them down and he would explain to them the dangers of wine. I'm scared. Sooner or later I'll have to do it, but you want to know the truth? I'm scared. Number one, he would have taught the world the dangers of wine. But number two, it would have penetrated himself. It's a man who thinks that his left hand is good enough to hold the steering wheel. It's not good enough. And a person who thinks it's good enough, somehow modest. But the death is there for such a man. This is the Maimininbo. When a person uses his right hand, he uses that over which he has most control. It just shows that little bit more care and concern. When a person learns Torah, it's learning a pshat in a chazal, and you notice he's using his right hand, not his left hand. If you see him sitting with his hands in his pockets and slouched on his chair, and he says he's got a vote for you after he's finished, tell him to go and tell the vote to somebody else. It'll do less harm. It can't be right. It can't be accurate. It can be dangerous. It's a Maimininbo. That means he doesn't realize the danger of making a mistake in the understanding of the Chazal. Because if he did, he wouldn't be slouching with his hands in his pockets. He would be sweating over his sefer, and the sweat marks would be falling onto the sforim. The drips of sweat would be falling onto the sforim. And he would have his hands on the table, and his brow would be furrowed to work out that it must be absolutely accurate, it must be right, has to show them that he shouldn't draw a conclusion from the Torah which is incorrect. That's the Samachai. From such a person one can assume, hopefully, that he's done his best to understand it properly. One can hopefully assume that in fact he has. It certainly isn't the son Hamovis. So it is with all the things that we do. There's such a thing as being over-cautious. We tend to show the caution for physical things. We said, Noah was a good farmer. He was terribly cautious. He chose wine. Why did he choose the vine? Because of its versatility. It was a good farming decision. It was the decision of a cautious man. And for that it's called Isha Adon. Noah, you're using all your caution in the area of agriculture. And you've forgotten to use that same caution in the area of spirituality, in the area of ruchnis. If you would look at yourself as well as the land, you would be a little bit more worried. It wouldn't come so quickly. From a farming point of view, your decision is good, so you get a new degree. From now on, you're no longer an ish tzaddik, an ish tomim, es ha'alukim is halech noach. Now you've got a bachelor of agriculture, or a doctorate of agriculture. An ish ra'adom. Who wants such a thing? Who wants to be called that? After being called a tzaddik tomim, to be called an ish ra'adom? Simply a shift of caution. A man who phones up, or the lady who phones up and says, sorry, I can't be at the shul this evening. I've got a cold. What can one say? Forget the cold. Come. Can't say such a thing to a person. He's got a cold. He's not feeling well. It's physically, it's the right decision. But if the same man thought to himself, the consequences of missing the shul, and then it's going to take me 2 days or 3 days before I start following again what's going on, and I'm behind, and this, and that, and the other, and Olam Haba is involved as well, and tefillah b'tzibur, he's not davening with a minion. Why? He's tired, or he's not well, or he's always a good reason. It's not as if there's no reason. It's a good reason. But it's a good reason if you're a bachelor of agriculture. It's a good reason if you have a bachelor of physical education or physical training. It's a good reason if you have an MBA. But it's not a good reason if you're trying to become an ish tzaddik tomim. There one's sense of caution has to be directed in other areas. And one has to use that same reticence that one uses in things physical. One has to use that same reticence in things spiritual. And fear the consequences sometimes of not going, of not doing what one's supposed to do. Noach begins with this. A tragic beginning for the whole of Klal Yisrael, for the whole of humanity. This was a chance to start again. And just as we learned last week, that things went wrong because of a minute mistake, but the problem was where the mistake was. It was in the foundation. You have a crack on the 50th floor, it's not such a problem. You remove the 50th floor, you patch it up. If you have a crack at the foundation, even if it's a very small crack, it endangers the entire building. In Bereishis, there was a thin, hairline crack, but it was at the foundation of humanity. And things deteriorated from there for 10 generations until God was ready to destroy the world again. And he takes Noach and his family and he says, let's start again. And everything's going beautifully. Noach, with the most unbelievable Mesilas Nefesh in the Teva and the Ark, looks after the animals and his family. He doesn't sleep a wink. He feeds every animal at the right time for that particular animal. Only once was he late for one animal's food. You know what that is? To understand, to have studied the needs of every animal to the extent that he was never late for each animal's feed. That each animal got the food exactly when he needed to. Only once he was late for the lion, and the lion gave him a scratch for that. He suffered as a result of that. He was punished. The tzidkus of Noach, constantly, without a stop, comes out and he's establishing civilization again. And there's a hairline crack. Just a hairline crack. But it's at the foundation. It's in the motivation of his first planting. That's all. The planting was good, it needed to be done. The action was good. It was just the zrizus. It was just the motivation expressed by an over-enthusiasm which showed that deep, deep subconsciously in the mind of Noach there was something in addition to the Lashem Shemayim. Had it been one of us who'd done that, it wouldn't have mattered that much. 50th floor, the 1,000th floor, you remove the floor and you carry on building from there. But it wasn't, it was at the foundation. It was in Noach. It was in the beginning of civilization. And it was in the motivation of that first act. Right at the very bottom of the building. at the very first level of the foundation, that's where the hairline crack appeared. And for that, Chazal tell us all sorts of consequences occurred. The Golus, in which we are today. All the Galuyas, all the times that Yisrael had to leave Eretz Yisrael and to live under the conditions that we live today, that's all traceable back to that moment. Wouldn't have happened if it weren't for that. Avdus. The fact that we have such a concept as Avodim, as slaves. And don't think that slaves are only the people whom Abraham Lincoln freed, and that once he freed them, there were none left. They're still there. He didn't free anybody. You can't free a slave. Slave is a slave, remains a slave. There's nothing you can do about it. Eliezer was an Eved, and he remained an Eved, and for that reason he couldn't marry Avram's, or his child couldn't marry Avram's son. He was one of the children of Ham. He was descended from Ham, and therefore he couldn't marry into a Jewish family. Despite all the training and all the working and all the involvement in Avram's household and all the Torah, he couldn't become liberated. It's not possible for an Eved to become liberated. And if Avinu couldn't liberate Eliezer, and Avram Lincoln couldn't liberate his slaves. Doesn't work. And slavery, one has to understand, the Egyptians, for example, the Mitzrim, who were at that time the height of civilization and liberation, and they were the masters of slaves. No slave had ever escaped from Egypt. Yet they too were Avodim, they too were descendants of Ham. When we talk about an Eved, we're not necessarily talking about a person who employs somebody rather than is employed by somebody. And Eved is the mentality of a slave. Mitzvah Hashem, next week we'll try and understand a little bit further what is an Eved and what are his origins and where does he come from. But if one looks in today's world, how much of the tzoros we suffer throughout the world, and analyze a little bit further next week, which Noach gave to his son Ham and to his grandson Canaan. We don't stand today at the origins of civilization, and therefore the mistakes that we make are not mistakes that are going to affect civilization in the same way. However, we also have our origins. Every day has its origin. Starting the day on the wrong foot affects everything. It's not the same. Making a mistake during the first 10 minutes of one's day is not the same as making a mistake later on. If one makes a wrong decision at 4 o'clock in the afternoon or at 7 o'clock in the evening, good, okay, it's a wrong decision, it's been a long day already. If one makes a wrong decision at 6 o'clock in the morning, it's a wrong decision which affects the rest of the day and it's irreversible. That's the foundation of the day. How one wakes up in the morning determines everything else that one does during that day. When one walks into one's office or one's workshop and one starts one's day's work, the way one walks, the way one sits down, what's at one's mind as one takes one's first tool up, whether it's a pencil or a tool or whatever, that affects everything else that one does during that day. If you make a mistake there, it has consequences one after the other. It has a chain effect. Later on, you make a mistake. You make a mistake, that's it. You often hear people saying, today's just been one of those days. From the beginning, everything's gone wrong. Of course everything went wrong, because at the beginning, everything went wrong. Not from the beginning. It's because at the beginning, something went wrong, therefore everything goes wrong. Must go wrong. If you're reasoning something else and you make a mistake in your initial premise, can you imagine how that mistake gets magnified and magnified and magnified as you take the reasoning further and further? Of course it does. If you're aiming a rocket at some distant planet, and you're a millionth of a degree off at the origin, and from there on the rocket goes straight, can you imagine by how many hundreds of thousands or millions of miles the rocket's going to miss its ultimate destination? A tiny mistake at the origin has vast ramifications at the end. And we too have our origins. When one starts to teach a child, when one starts to educate a child, the first 3 years of a child's life, how important, how vital that is. You can't afford mistakes at that time. One can't afford to raise the child in a way which later on I'll correct if I make it. Can't correct it later on if you've made a mistake. If you've made a hash up of that, that's finished. You're responsible. Let a child develop in a way where he's not made to stand on his own 2 feet, where he's not able to develop himself, to strive for himself, to achieve for himself. If he's overprotected and he's looked after in a way which deprives him of the thrills of achievement in those first 3 years, it's for fun and that's the end of it. Can't do it later. One teaches a child Torah, One teaches an adult Torah, the first years of a person learning Torah. It's a hatchola, it's a beginning, it has to be done right. And so it is with each single thing that one does, with a shidduch. One gets married or is in the process of getting married, it has to be done right from the beginning. One starts establishing a home, it has to be kept right from the beginning. Very hard to change later on, very hard to start a home on certain standards and increase the standards later on. It's much easier to lower the standard later on. The time when one has to start the standards is then, right at the beginning. Unfortunately, in our own personal lives, there is such a thing as tshuva. We've come out of the Rosh Hashanah period, fully aware of that concept. There is such a thing as making a new beginning. But then one has to know, if one's made a new beginning, then exactly it follows the rules of the beginning. And if one's starting from scratch, one has to start with the meticulousness of starting from scratch. And one has to realize that the Ribbono Shel Olam does give us a chance, but that chance has to be handled with that kind of care. We can't stand on Yom Kippur and say, well, we'll start again, and come 2 weeks after Sukkot, and already we're using our left hands. That caution, that care, that worry is gone, finished, until next Rosh Hashanah. That doesn't work. If we were able to develop an understanding of missed opportunities, and we ask for a new beginning, that's good, we get the new beginning. But then it's necessary to handle it as a new beginning, and to understand that it's the moments after takeoff which are the most dangerous. You can't glide to a gentle stop as you can when you've reached high altitudes. You can't do that if you're just busy taking off. At the initial stages of one's flight, at the initial stages of one's movement through anything, through a day, through a shiur, through a marriage, through a business venture, those initial stages are what's going to affect everything that comes thereafter. One cannot afford the hairline cracks. Right from the motivation of one's actions through to the carrying out of those actions. We have to endeavor as far as we're able to ensure that there is in those motivations and actions a kedusha and a tahara, a holiness and a purity.